everyone. Welcome to the Redefining Physical Therapy Teleseminar, and welcome to episode 3 here, where I am with Dr. Zach Couples, formerly strength coach and PT with the Memphis Grizzlies. Dr. Couples also is a PRI trained therapist. He trained under renowned physical therapist Bill Hartman, and he has his OCS, and he's got an array of different experiences. And so he is our episode 3 guest, and it's exciting for me to get Dr. Couples on here. He is actually someone I've personally wanted to interview, so selfishly I kind of chose him for this. So without further ado, here is Dr. Couples.
Well, Scott, I appreciate you having me on this podcast, and I've heard of you from afar, and it's nice to finally see your face. And I wanted to thank you first off for writing that ebook that you wrote on the examination. That is an immensely helpful resource, and I wish I'd gotten that about 2 years ago. So thank you.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it didn't take too long to put together, but at least some people are reading it.
Yeah.
So Zach, why don't you tell everyone a little bit, you know, what interests you with physical therapy, why you got into the profession, and what you're up to today?
Sure. I think the biggest thing that excites me about what we do and kind of what my MO is with this thing is to help people become the best version of themselves. And so a lot of what excites me right now is just managing someone comprehensively. So while I think we can do a lot with our rehab modalities, that's only a small fraction of what's going on in a person's day. So the more variables that we can impact, be it physical training, be it sleep hygiene, be it nutrition, be it stress management, the more likely we are to have a successful outcome over the long term, and the more likely we can make people the best version of themselves. So that's what excites me. In terms of what I'm up to nowadays, I'm doing a lot of writing, working on some projects, and a little bit of informal consulting on the side while planning my next move.
Awesome. So it sounds kind of like you kind of look beyond just physical therapy, you know, fitness levels, stress, fatigue, nutrition, and all these other variables that kind of impact recovery and, you know, outcomes.
I think you have to, man. It's just the patients aren't getting any easier, so the more areas we can impact, the more likely we are to be successful.
Perfect. All right, well, Zach, we're going to hop right into our talk tonight, and so we'll go ahead and get started. So Zach is going to be actually talking about an athlete that he helps rehabilitate with a fifth met head fracture. So Zach, why don't you just go ahead and give us a little bit of the details of the case?
Sure. So this happened. I got to witness this injury, which is not fun, but we were playing a game, and this guy gets hit. All of a sudden, he falls to the ground, grabbing his foot. Long story short, he is diagnosed with a fifth metatarsal fracture, and he's going to be out for a little while. So that's basically how the injury had happened.
Okay. And so then immediately after that, take me through, you know, what was your examination? How did you rule in a fracture? Obviously, you probably had access to imaging. Is there any other test that you did to kind of rule that in?
So with my position that I was working at, I had an athletic trainer that I collaborated with, and she did the initial examination with the injury immediately after it happened. A lot of that just involved palpation, and you know, if you utilize your Ottawa foot and ankle rules, pain over the fifth metatarsal area, probably something you need imaging for. And so we were able to get imaging pretty quickly. Fracture was diagnosed, and he was able to get surgery the following week. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty much what we used to rule in the fracture.
Okay, so he had so you basically immobilized him then. He had ORIF or?
So, yes, he had an ORIF, and then he was, it was kind of weird because it wasn't like true non-weight bearing with him. He was able to bear weight through his heel, which was immensely helpful, but we had him in a boot for 6 weeks. After 6 weeks had occurred, we were able to have him go to weight bearing as tolerated, and then the initial plan was the physician was going to clear him in 8 weeks to return to play. So that was kind of the healing process timeline that we were given from the physician.
Now, during that time for the 6 weeks, what things were you working on to help maybe make sure he didn't lose his conditioning, strength, mobility? Were you working the ankle at all? That involved, like, so the ankle didn't stiffen up? Kind of take me through that.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So let's kind of look overall at, like, what the goals are for this guy, because I'm always thinking of what's the end in sight. And fortunately, I was able to watch him play many games, so I already had a sense of how he moved, what his style of play was, so on and so forth. And so from that, we kind of divided the schedule of his rehab into four phases. And so the first phase was the non-weight-bearing phase. And when I approach each phase, we're looking to improve things with this guy from a tactical standpoint, a performance standpoint, and a medical standpoint. So from a medical standpoint, if we look at a lot of his initial objective tests, he actually was incredibly mobile in the foot-ankle complex. So much so that, I mean, he had excessive inversion with minimal eversion. And having seen him stand before, he would stand with a much more supinated foot on that right side. So there really wasn't much mobility work that we had to do locally aside from scar tissue mobilization over the scar. A lot of his physical therapy focused more on addressing some other areas that he was limited in. So he had some limitations in frontal plane mobility of the hips, as well as a little bit of what I would consider hypermobility in the hamstrings via straight leg raise. So this is where I use some of my PRI methodology, in the sense that we emphasize a lot of sagittal plane control initially, so we could influence hip mobility favorably. And from that point, we went into a little bit more frontal plane work in the non-weight-bearing phase, so we could work on teaching him how to pronate his foot while incorporating hip abduction and hip external rotation. Because if you're standing and you go and pronate your foot, you have to look at what your knee's doing. And the knee obviously falls into valgus and internal rotation. So if you can teach an individual to maintain a pronated foot while externally rotating and abducting the hip, that allows for more favorable mechanics to occur at the extremity and allows for greater push-off force to occur because you are influencing the entire kinetic chain. So that was a bulk of what our rehab sessions looked like. What we also worked on to mitigate potential atrophy that can occur with non-weight bearing is hypertrophy. And the modality that I used was blood flow restriction training, which is, I mean, the amount of research that modality has is just astounding, Scott. I don't know if you've read much into it, but if you occlude the leg from getting or losing or getting venous return, but allowing arterial blood flow, that creates a metabolic stress within the tissues that are occluded, so much so that it induces protein metabolism and hormonal influences. And so by using that modality and just doing simple things like leg presses and hamstring curls, we were able to pretty much mitigate any atrophy. And I mean, throughout the whole process, in that 6 week phase that he was non weight bearing, he had no atrophy in that limb. It was pretty remarkable.
That's funny you mentioned that. I just took a course over the weekend, and I was sitting with an NFL PT who was in the course I was at, and we were talking a little bit about blood flow restriction training. He's actually getting ready to do a case study on one of his athletes that he used with a fracture. So yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. Now, have you seen anything about far as speeding up the bone healing process, or is it solely more muscular hypertrophy gains that you're seeing?
I haven't come across anything with that in the literature. Although, now that I think about it, when I took the course with Johnny Owens, he's kind of the pioneer in propagating this information. I think he did have some research that showed that by influencing the or by by using that modality, because it loads the bone a little bit differently. So I think it does allow for some bone stimulation to occur, but I don't have the reference on that.
Sure. Okay. So that was kind of your beginning phase treatment then, right? Mm-hmm. So it was non-weight bearing.
From a medical standpoint, yes.
Okay.
At the same time, we also have to consider that this guy's going to get back to playing high-level basketball. So we have to maintain his conditioning levels. And so the way we did that via two methods, as best as you can. One is we did strength training with all the other limbs that weren't affected. And so his program would involve a lot of upper body power via med ball throws. We do a lot of bench pressing, chin-ups. And we also worked on the left leg. So he did a lot of single leg squats that were supported via TRX and single leg RDLs. And, you know, if you look at the research, if you strengthen the non-involved side, you get a little bit of carryover to the other side. And then from a conditioning standpoint, a lot of aerobic work was emphasized. Because aerobic exercise promotes the healing process and is very sport-specific for basketball. So we did a lot of tempo intervals on the bike and a lot of cardiac output work, and then that was our conditioning piece. And then to make sure we kept him involved in basketball, we had him do a lot of form shooting in the seated position so he didn't lose that skill, as well as ball handling.
I like that you highlighted aerobic activity increases healing. I actually use that with my athletes, and you know, obviously you want to maintain their conditioning levels, but also it like you said, it improves healing. So that's good.
For sure. And it doesn't have to be just this steady state stuff. I mean, if you look at all the great stuff that Joel Jamison's putting out, I mean, there's multiple ways to stimulate the aerobic system as opposed to being a hamster for an hour.
Right, right. No kidding. All right, so then take me through the other progressions then.
For sure. So once he was cleared to weight bear, they initially cleared him to weight bear for 2 weeks, not run. So from that standpoint, if we go from medical first, a lot of the PRI activities that I were doing, we emphasized frontal plane and standing. So a lot of this would be isometric holds that involved hip abduction while standing on the left leg, a lot of right squat activities, basically anything that incorporates pronation, hip external rotation, and hip abduction in standing. Then we introduced a lot of bilateral and single leg stance activities to help build local fitness. So we got him doing front squats, we got him doing trap bar deadlifts, a lot of split stance and single leg exercises. And we loaded those pretty heavy. I mean, he was training with me before, so he was moving some big weight prior, and fortunately he had a lot of carryover, and we didn't have too much of a drop-off from a strength and power standpoint. So we used a lot of max effort work, keeping the rep ranges low, as well as a lot of tempo work. So I'd have him do 3-second eccentric, 3-second concentric to have a little bit more slow twitch hypertrophy.
Sure.
Development. And then from a conditioning standpoint, we kept it aerobic, but we did a lot more weight-bearing stuff. So I would use some elliptical sprints, a little bit more kind of extensive tempo method. So he was going fast, but it wasn't going too far over anaerobic threshold. And then we used high-intensity continuous training as well. And what that is, for those who don't know, it's used to stimulate fast twitch muscle oxidative capabilities, and basically it's doing a bunch of reps over a period of time very fast. And so we use step-ups. That was our primary method because it also reinforced the foot pronation and hip external rotation that was desirable. And we had him do a step-up, rest, 1 to 3 seconds, or actually 3 to 5, I should say, and then do another step up. It's very boring, but it's very, very effective. And then from a tactical standpoint, we got him doing a little bit of form shooting and standing, and we would allow him to go raise up on his toes, but not do any jumping.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I will say when I was playing football at Butler, I trained with Hartman, and he had me do the step-ups, and obviously I had some of my athletes do it as a strength coach, and that is brutal. It's like a weird fatigue, you know?
It's so bizarre. Yeah. You don't like feel it until you're done and you're like, man, I'm dead. And right. then you look down and there's just sweat.
Everywhere. I know, right?
Just sweat.
I know. Yeah, so that's definitely a tough workout.
Yeah.
All right, so then take me back through your progression after all that. So that at this stage in the game, is he ready to return to play? I guess, what is your how are you guys validating this athlete is ready to go back to the court?
For sure. So there's a couple things. First thing is he has to be cleared to run. So we make sure that the medical clearance from the doc was given the okay. As mad as he was, I wouldn't clear him for full play because you have, the tissue is healed doesn't mean the tissue is conditioned to meet the demands of that high level of a sport. So there was a couple things that we looked at. We did a lot of the hop testing that's very common after an ACL repair. So I use single leg hop, triple hop, and crossover hop. And in his case, he was symmetrical from a strength standpoint, but was not symmetrical from a landing standpoint in the sense that he landed very hard and stiff-legged. So a lot of our later work involved plyometrics that worked on that. So that's one of my big keys to make sure that locally the tissue has enough force to sustain the play loads. The other key, and this is probably the most important key, is load management when you grade him back to sport. And so I don't know if you're familiar with Tim Gabbett's work.
Yeah,
the acute to chronic workload measure, that's one of my foundational pieces to ensure that we safely bring him along from a general physical preparation to a special physical preparation. And you can't really start it effectively until they're playing basketball because load management is activity specific. Just because you have maximized general methods doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get much carryover from a fitness standpoint towards special methods. And so because I didn't have a lot of external load monitoring technology, such as your Catapult, your StatSport, we kept it pretty simple and measured internal load by calculating how long he did court work and what his rating of perceived exertion was. Was it the most accurate thing? Because, he would be dripping and sweat dying and he'd rate the session a 3 because he's playing basketball and he's happy. But it at least gives me something to grade how he's doing. And aside from that, it's just asking how he's feeling, watching him do the basketball activity. One interesting thing that happened as he was performing a lot of the drills that we were doing was by this time he was able to land softly on a lot of the plyometric activities we were doing. But as soon as we got him to do some jumping, whether it be a finish at the basketball at the rim or working on a Euro step, he'd go back to thudding. And again, this was a kind of an epiphany for me in the sense that just because you've mastered it from a general standpoint doesn't mean you're going to get carryover to sport. So a lot of our work focused on making sure he was able to land softly on his right leg and also jump off his right leg comfortably. Because that was another thing he would do was he'd go into a finish and he'd jump off his left leg and he wouldn't jump off his right, even though he had jumped off his right countless times. So basically over the course of the next few weeks before we allowed him to play to a game, we made sure that we built up his workload by keeping him in a safe acute to chronic measure and making sure that a lot of these foundational skills were met with at least technical competency.
Sure. I think that Gabbett's work is a game changer, I think, for other sports physios out there if you're not familiar with it. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think 10% acute to chronic, if it exceeded 10% workload, that the athlete was more likely to develop a soft tissue injury? Or
so it's if it's one, like the numbers that I stick with are I try to keep them between 0.8 and 1.3 of an acute to chronic ratio.
Yeah, that's right.
I think if it's over 1.5, the ratio is over 1.5, there's a certain amount of increase of injury risk, and then 2.0 is significantly more, that just compounds from there. And that's not just injury of the area, but any soft tissue injury. And I mean, tracking this stuff with all of our players, it's pretty remarkable how accurate it is.
Sure. Now, Zach, go ahead and talk a little bit about, so you and I both know, so you could do all these tests, you know, in a isolated scenario, you know, with the coach, but then when you go to play, right, you don't use it. There's a lot of other variables. So after they master kind of, you know, plyometrics and all the different planes and that sort of thing, do you then let them practice for a couple more weeks before you say, okay, he looks normal, he's doing these things, or do you just kind of say, you know, he's able to tolerate all these different jumping and landing, he's not thudding, or landing, stomping his feet?
Yeah. So with that, again, the acute chronic workload is one of the biggest influences. And so, you know, even though he was cleared to play at 8 weeks, we didn't allow him to play until about 11, because we wanted to ensure that as he was getting back to practice, that his workloads were in a safe enough range that he could tolerate a game. And fortunately, I had a little bit of data prior to his injury to show how much, what his workload numbers were like at hard practices or at games. So I could compare those two numbers. And that gave me some credence to say, yes, he's safe to play. But we also graded his progression back from a drill standpoint. And so a lot of the early phase drills incorporated maybe just doing shorter bursts with longer recovery. And I use, well, it's common for a lot of people to progress a drill from a non-contact to directly a contact drill. I think you can use an intermediary between those two, what I call controlled contact. And basically this is where I, the clinician, and providing the contact, because I know not only what he can and can't do, but also what positions are going to be most beneficial for him to get into to allow him to have a little bit more transfer for some of the general methods that I employ. And so what I would do is I would play defense against him. And I would force him to push off of that right side or jump off that right side. And then when he would go to a finish, I would get out of the way so I know he could finish safely, and I might just push him a little bit. So control, like, that's kind of how we graded him from being allowed to do practice in a, you know, maybe first in a non-contact situation to then full contact practice. And then, like I said, once he had a safe enough workload level to play a game, we allowed him to play a game. If you look at the research from a basketball standpoint, if you can keep someone under 18 minutes, that's generally a safe amount of playing time for someone to return back. And so a lot of the initial games were under that amount. And then, you know, by the end, he was able to play a significant amount of minutes. We probably progressed him a little bit faster than I would like in that sense, but I think you also have to consider bending the rules of the Hippocratic Oath a little bit, because while it may not be safe for him to play a large amount of minutes, we also have to incur some risk, because him playing that amount of minutes might get him paid. And that's the chance of that happening is much greater for his well-being than sustaining a re-injury. So, like just being able, just kind of having that a problem placed onto you, I think it puts a lot of, it just at least alters your perspective of what the end goal is throughout the entire rehab process.
Sure, yeah, that's a great point. Now, Zach, two more questions. Now, what do you guys do? I mean, I know as an athlete, sometimes, you know, physically you might be ready, but mentally you're just not ready, you don't trust it. I guess, how do you kind of gauge that this athlete is mentally ready to return to sport?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I've seen both ends of the spectrum. Fortunately, this guy, I mean, if I would have told him to run through a brick wall, he would have ran through two brick walls. But when you have the opposite of that, I think it's just a matter of finding what they're willing to do And if they can't do that, find the next closest thing to that task that's safe, that they're willing to do. And it's just, I mean, you go along the same progression that I outlined. So if someone is uncomfortable, say, doing a finish off of their right leg at the rim, well, can you do it off your left? Okay, cool. And then maybe if you're not comfortable with that, well, are you comfortable with doing a, you know, a floater off the right leg? If that's not the case, can you do a jump shot? And then it will be like, once we found that, well, let's milk that area for as long as we can, and then try to reintroduce the next step when possible. So I think it's just a matter of making sure you have solid progressions and regressions that you can, you know, continually shift to and from.
Sure. All right, Zach, so putting you on the spot, give our audience a clinical pearl that they can apply today in the clinic.
All right, Scott, here's my clinical pearl, and it's kind of my new mantra, I think, in rehab, and that's start at the end. And so what I mean by this is, regardless of where you're at in the rehab process, you always have to keep the patient's goal in mind. And a lot of times you can circumvent a lot of the stuff that I had talked about, obviously not in a surgical case, but a lot of times you can circumvent a lot of our rehab modalities if you just address the task that they're doing. So I'll give you a couple patient examples of this. Like I had one guy who he had a knee contusion after a game, and I did every rehab trick in the book. And nothing seemed to get it better. He still had some pain, you know, coming out of cuts and coming off screens and with shooting. And so what I did was I just watched how he was doing that, and he was barely dipping at all down into a squat or not getting low out of the cuts because it hurt. And so we worked on his mechanics at doing that. And lo and behold, he was able to perform everything once he did things technically well without pain. And, like, had I started there, I may have gotten him back to playing sooner than if I had not just gone down a rehab rabbit hole. You know, and we do this stuff all the time and not think of it. Like, I've also had another case where I had someone who had low back pain with sitting. Well, let me see how you sit. Well, if you're perched at the edge of the chair and your back's arched and you're, you know, hunched over the computer, well, we can go into the posture debate. But, like, well, what if you try sitting a way different than that? Does that help? If it does, great. Then you've done your job and you don't have to do all the rehab stuff. So just look at the task that individual has to perform. See if you can change that. And if that works, great. You've saved yourself and the patient a great deal of time.
Awesome. Good stuff, Zach. So we're going to wrap up tonight, Zach. I want to thank you for being a part of this. Where can other people, where can people find more stuff from you? Because I know you have a blog and a website. Go ahead and tell our audience where they can find you on social media and your website.
For sure. So I do a lot of my work out of my blog, and that's Zach Couples, ZACCUPPLES.com. I write about kind of whatever strikes me in the moment. So that's a great place to find me. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook. The handle's Z Couples, my last name. And then I'm slowly getting onto Instagram. That's Couples Performance. I just got to figure out how to use it and maybe, you know, think of something worthwhile to show those people. So those are the three ways you can find me on social media. I'm also happy to answer emails, not always in a timely manner, but if you email me, my email is couplesperformance@gmail.com. You can also reach me there.
All right, Zach. Thanks again for being part of this. I appreciate it.
Yep, thank you for having me, Scott.